I drink it parked, then decide to take a detour. I'm wearing a large pair of sunglasses, a blonde wig, and a floppy hat, and it's close to sunset when I park 4 blocks away and walk to the empty lot that used to be our family home. It's nice, this little park. Thick green grass, neatly maintained. There's a border of bright flowers and a stark marble square with a fountain bubbling on top of it. I read the inscription, which says nothing about this being a murder scene at all. It only lists the names of Mel's victims and a date, and at the end, peace be in this place. There's a bench invitingly close. There's another small wrought iron table and chairs on a concrete patio 10 feet farther off, where our living room might have been. I don't sit down. I don't have the right in this place to make myself at ease. I just look, bow my head a moment, and walk off. If anyone's watching, I don't want them to recognize me or approach me. I just want to be a lady out for a walk on a nice day. It feels like I'm being watched, but I think that's the weight of guilt on my shoulders. Ghosts must surely still linger here, angry and hungry. I can't blame them for that. I can only blame myself. I'm walking fast by the time I reach my car again, and I pull out a little too quickly, as if something is chasing me. It takes miles for me to feel secure again, to strip off the suffocating, sweaty weight of the wig and hat. I keep the sunglasses on. The sun sets too bright without them. I pull over again and take out my tablet computer. The reception isn't great, and I have to wait for the feed to load, but there it is, my house, viewable from the front door, the back, the long view, the inside. I can see Sam Cade out back, hammering boards on the unfinished deck. I call Sam, and he tells me all's well there. It sounds like a normal, placid day. Uneventful. Normality sounds like heaven. Unattainable and forbidden. I'm all too aware how much power Mel still has over us. How he found us, I don't know, and probably never will. He's got a source, that's clear enough. Whoever is passing him information might not even be aware of the harm they're doing. He's a good liar. He's always been a master manipulator. He's a virulent virus loose on the world, and I should have used my shot at him to just kill the son of a bitch. If I call Absalom to set up something more final, it'll cost more than I can safely pay. I know that. And when it comes to buying a murder, even the murder of a man on death row, there's something in me that balks. Maybe it's just a fear that I'll be caught and my kids will be left alone in the world, helpless and unprotected. I'm extra cautious on the rest of the drive, hyper-aware of possible people trailing me, yet desperate to get home now. Every minute I'm gone is another minute I'm not there to protect my children, to act as their shield. I use express drop-off for the rental car. Security seems to take an eternity, and I want to scream at the idiots who don't know how to take their shoes off, or their laptops out, or their phones from their pockets. It doesn't matter, because once I'm through, I find the flight out to Knoxville has been canceled. I have another 2-hour wait for the next flight, and I find myself calculating the distance. I have a frantic impulse to drive it, to be doing something. But that would take even longer, of course. I have to wait, and I do it sitting by a plug, charging my tablet. I watch the feed from the house as the sun starts to set, and the picture adjusts to a grainier grayscale image. I flip to the inside camera and find that Sam is sitting on the sofa with a glass in his hand, watching TV. Lanny is making something in the kitchen. I don't see Connor, but he's probably in his room. I keep watching the outside of the house, in case of anything. I keep the display on even as the flight finally boards and reluctantly thumb it off when the flight attendant tells me to disable the internet function. I'm trying not to think about what might happen during the time I'm in the air. It's not a very long flight, but it's long enough. I pull the tablet out as soon as the sign indicates I can, hook it up to the costly airplane Wi-Fi, and check again. It's all peaceful, eerily calm. I think about Mel's bloody smile, and I find myself shivering like I'm freezing. Maybe I am. I turn off the overhead air and ask for a blanket, and I watch the tablet's slow, glitching feed throughout the flight, until we're heading into the airport. It takes forever to get to the gate and deplane. I'm watching the cameras the whole shuffling way up to the door, and the instant I'm through, I stow the tablet and run down the jet bridge tunnel, dodging other passengers, and sprint through the terminal toward the exit. I feel the hot breath on the back of my neck again. I feel something like the light graze of snapping teeth. Then I'm outside in the humid darkness and looking frantically for where I parked my Jeep. When I find it, I check the cameras again, and then I leave the tablet up and active on the passenger seat as I speed away from the airport and head toward Stillhouse Lake. I call Sam and tell him I'm on the way. Whenever it's safe on the drive, I snatch glimpses of the camera feeds as I reassure myself that my children are all right, that no one has gotten to them. All the way, I remember that ghostly, ghastly smile on Mel's broken face. That smile tells me he's not done, that we're not done. 6. Darkness already has a firm hold as I make the turn on the road out to Stillhouse Lake. I go too fast, speeding around the inky turns, hoping no one is walking this path tonight or driving with lights off. They aren't. It's quiet, and I pull into my driveway with a sense of relief, which is paradoxical because this home, this sanctuary, isn't safe anymore. It's an illusion. It's always been an illusion. Sam Cade is sitting on the porch drinking a beer as I pull up and shut off the Jeep's headlights. I reach for the tablet to shut it off, only to find that the battery is completely drained. I stow it and take a couple of breaths to compose myself. Somehow, I never expected to arrive and find everything okay, even though that was my fondest hope. I get out and walk up to join Sam on the porch. He silently hands me a cold Samuel Adams, which I twist open and swig gratefully. It tastes wonderfully like coming home. "That's a hell of a quick trip," he says. "Everything okay?" I wonder what kind of vibe I'm giving off that he'd ask. "Yeah, I think so. Just some business I needed to take care of. It's done." "No, it isn't. Nothing is done." I thought he'd get the message, but instead he wasn't even worried. He isn't afraid of me. That means I'd better be afraid of him. Again. "Well, we got the deck frame built out. A few more days to put the boards down and waterproof, and it'll be ready to use." He hesitates, then says, "Gwen, the police came around about an hour ago. Said they wanted to re-interview you about, you know, the girl in the lake. I told them you'd call." My stomach lurches, but I nod and hope that I seem just fine with that. "I guess they're still grasping at straws about the dead woman. I was hoping they'd settle that by now." "Or is this something new? Something courtesy of Mel?" "Guess nothing's settled since they haven't caught the killer," he says. He takes another drink. "You're not holding back anything, are you?"
"No, of course not."
"I only ask because I didn't like the feeling they gave me. Just be careful when you talk to them, okay? Maybe take a lawyer along."
"A lawyer?"
My first impulse is shock and rejection, but then I reconsider. It might be a good idea. I could confess everything about my past to an attorney, and he'd have to keep it under seal. Maybe finally unburdening myself would feel good. And maybe it wouldn't. If I still can't fully trust Sam with all my secrets, trusting some country lawyer out of Norton would be nearly impossible. It's a small town. People talk. I change the subject. "How are the kids?" "All fine. Pizza for dinner. They've got homework. Not too happy about it. The homework, I mean. They were really into the food." "Well, that's normal." I suddenly realize that I'm starving. I've gone without anything more solid than coffee and a soft drink all day.
"Any pizza left?"
"With two kids? You're dreaming if you think they didn't finish a large all by themselves." Sam smiles a little. "But I ordered two for that very reason. Just needs a little heating up."
"Sounds like heaven. Join me?"
So we find ourselves sitting at the kitchen table in a companionable silence as I eat two slices and think about a third. Lanny breezes in from her bedroom to grab an energy drink and steal a slice. She raises an eyebrow and says, "You're back." "Don't sound so thrilled." She rounds her eyes and flutters her hands and pitches her voice into the annoying saccharine level.
"You're back! Oh, Mom, I missed you so much!"
I nearly choke on my pizza. She smirks and retreats to her room, slamming the door even though she doesn't need to. That makes Connor stick his head out. He sees me and gives me a quiet grin. "Hi, Mom."
"Hi, honey.
You need any help with your homework?"
"Nah, I got it. It's easy. I'm glad you're back."
From him, it sounds sincere, and I smile back with real warmth. The warmth fades as Connor withdraws back into his room, and I'm faced with a stark reality. Mel knows where we are. He knows. He talked about Brady. Specifically, about my son. The answer's obvious. Javier has the van ready. All I have to do is drive the Jeep over and pick up the van, load us up, and go. Find a new place to start over. We can use the emergency IDs I have buried in the geocache 50 miles from here. I've also split part of the money there, and I'll leave it for now. I have better than 30,000 with me, still. I'll have to pay Absalom in Bitcoin to get us new, clean papers and backstories once we burn these identities, and that'll cost us another 10,000 at the least. From the ease with which he does it, I can only think he works for some shadowy spy agency where false identities are as common as junk mail. Melvin expects me to run. He said as much. But everyone runs from the monster. Everyone except the monster slayer. A voice says in my head. Not Mel's, this time. My own. It sounds calm and cool and utterly capable. Don't do this. You're happy here. Don't let him win. You have the upper hand and he knows it. He doesn't want to die, and you can always, always pull that trigger. I think about it, finishing the pizza and the beer. Sam watches me, but he hasn't broken the silence, hasn't asked. I like that he doesn't. I finally say, "Sam, I have something to tell you. If you walk away, that's okay. I won't blame you at all. But I need to trust someone, and I've decided that it's going to be you." He looks ever so slightly taken aback, and he says, "Gwen?" I sense he wants to tell me something, and I wait. But it doesn't come. Finally, he shakes his head. "Okay, hit me." "Outside," I say. "I don't want the kids overhearing." We go out into the coolness and settle in the chairs together. There are wisps of cloudy vapor coming off the lake tonight, rendering it eerie and mysterious. The moon's only half, but it rides a clear sky scattered with stars, like a country road sign that's been shotgunned, and it's bright enough to see each other. I don't look at him as I start, though. I don't want to see the moment of realization. "My real name isn't Gwen Proctor," I tell him. "It's Gina Royal." I wait. His body language from the corner of my eye doesn't change. He says, "Okay," and I realize he must not know the name. "I used to be the wife of Melvin Royal. You might remember him. The Kansas Horror." He takes in a sharp breath and sinks back in the chair, puts his beer to his lips and drains it dry, then sits silently, turning the bottle in his hands. I hear a ripple from the lake. Someone's out in the fog, I guess. No engines. They're rowing. It's a dark night for it, but some people like the dark. "I was put on trial as an accessory," I tell him. "They called me Melvin's little helper." "I wasn't. I didn't know anything about what he did, but that hardly mattered. People sure wanted to believe it. I was married to a monster, sleeping in his bed. How could I have not known?"
"It's a good question," Sam says.
"How?"
There's something hard in his voice. It hurts. I swallow hard, and I taste metal on the back of my tongue. "I don't know,"
except he was good at pretending to be a human being. A good father. God help me, I didn't see it coming. I just thought he was eccentric, that we drifted apart, like married couples do. I only found out when the SUV ran through the wall of the garage, and they discovered the last victim there. I saw her, Sam. I saw her. And I can never, ever forget what it was like. I stop and look at him. He's not facing me. He's watching the lake ripples, the fog rising. His face is so blank that I can't get any sense at all of what he feels. I was acquitted, but that doesn't mean much. The people who believe I'm guilty won't let go. They want to punish me, and they have. We've had to move, run, change our names more than once. Maybe they have a point, he says. It sounds different, rigid and harsh now. Maybe they still think you're guilty. I'm not. It aches now, this place inside where I'd thought hope might eventually grow. I can feel it dying in real time. And what about my children? They don't deserve any of this shit. Ever. He's silent for a long, long time, but he isn't standing up and leaving. He's thinking. I don't know what he's going over in his head, and I think half a dozen times he's going to speak. But then he thinks differently, and the moment's gone. When he does say something, it isn't what I expect. You must worry about being tracked down by the victim's families. Yes, all the time. It's hard for me to trust anyone, ever. Do you understand why? We finally have a home here, Sam. I don't want to run away from it. But now... Did you kill her? He asks me. The girl in the lake? Is that why you're telling me this now? I'm speechless. I stare at his profile and I can't form words. I feel numb, the way one does after a deep injury. I've made a terrible mistake, I think. Stupid, stupid woman. Because I would have never guessed Sam would make that turn that fast. No, I finally say. Because what else can I say? I've never killed anyone. I've never hurt anyone. That isn't quite true, I think. I remember Mel's bruises and cuts, the bitter satisfaction I got today from seeing the damage. But it's true except for that one special case. I don't know how I can convince you of that. He doesn't answer. We sit in the well of silence for a while. It's not comfortable, but I'm not willing to be the one to end it, either. Sam finally does. Gwen, I'm sorry. Should I still call you? Yes, I tell him. Always. Gina Royal is long dead, as far as I'm concerned. And your husband? Ex-husband. Alive. In El Dorado prison, I tell him. That's where I went today. You still visit him? I can't miss the revulsion in it. The betrayal, as if I've shattered some image he's held of me. God, Gwen. I don't, I tell him. This is the first time I've seen him since he was arrested. I'd rather slit my wrists than look at him, believe me. But he threatened me. He threatened my kids. That's what I'm trying to tell you. He's found out where we are. God knows how. All he has to do is drop a word to one of the people who've been stalking us. I had to see him to make it very clear that I wouldn't play this game with him. And how'd that go? About like I expected, I say. So I have a big decision to make. Run or stay. I want to stay, Sam, but... But it'd be a whole lot smarter to go, he says. Look, I have no idea what you're going through, but I wouldn't be as worried about an ex in prison as I would relatives of the victims. They lost a family member. Maybe they think if he loses one, that's justice. I do worry about that. I worry about real righteous grief and anger. I worry about the sterile, uncaring malice of the sicko patrol, for whom it's just an exercise in sociopathy. I worry about everyone. Maybe, I tell him. God, I can't even say I don't understand that, because I do. I stop and take another pull of my beer, just to rid myself of the bad taste.
Mel's on death row, but it'll be a long time before they ever strap him to a table. And I think he'll kill himself just before that happens. He won't want to give up that control.
Then maybe you shouldn't run, Sam says. That's what he expects, to keep you scared and on the move.
He pauses and finally puts the bottle down on the floor of the porch.
Are you scared?
Out of my mind, I tell him. With Mel, I'd have said out of my fucking mind. It's odd, I cursed like a sailor in Mel's presence because he'd brought out the rage bottled inside me. But I have no wish to use that language around Sam. I don't feel so defensive. I don't need the shield. I won't say I don't care what happens to me, of course I do. But my kids, they have enough to deal with, just being the children of someone like him. I know it's better for them to stay, but how do I take that risk?
Do they know about their father?
Yeah, most of it. I try to keep the horrible details from them, but I shrug helplessly. Age of the Internet. Lanny probably knows almost everything by now. Connor. God, I hope not. It's hard enough for an adult to handle knowing the worst. I can't imagine what it would do to someone his age.
Kids are stronger than you think.
Morbid, too, Sam says. I was. I poked around dead things, told gory stories. But there's a difference between imagination and reality. Just never let them see the pictures. I remember he was in Afghanistan. I wonder what he saw there, to give him that dark tone. More than I had, most likely, even though I'd had to be faced with all the horrible pictures, the horror and rage of the victims' families at my trial, those who had the stomach to come, which by that time wasn't nearly as many. When I'd been acquitted, there had only been about 4 of them who'd stayed for the verdict. 3 of them had threatened to kill me. Most of the families had been there for Mel's trial, or so I'd heard, and they'd been destroyed by it. He'd found it all very boring. He'd yawned, fallen asleep. He'd even laughed when a mother fainted on seeing for the first time a picture of the decaying face of her child floating under the water. I'd read the accounts of it. He'd thought that the woman's pain, that mother's pain, was the shit. Sam, I don't know what I want to say to him. I know what I want him to say, that it'll be all right, that he forgives me. That the peace we'd formed between us, the fragile, unnamed relationship, hasn't just been murdered by my words. He stands up, still facing toward the lake, and puts his hands in the pockets of his jeans. I don't need to be a psychologist to know that's a withdrawal. I know how hard this was for you to talk about, and I'm not saying I don't value your trust, but I have to think about this, he tells me. Don't worry. I won't tell anybody. Promise you that. I'd never have told you if I'd thought you would, I say. The hard part, I realize, isn't letting him know the truth. It's this ripping fear inside now that he'll turn his back on me, that this is the last moment we'll be friends, or even friendly. I never thought that would hurt, but it does. The fragile little roots I'd been putting down, ripping away. Maybe it's for the best, I try to tell myself, but all I feel is grief. Good night, Gwen, he says as he starts down the steps, but he doesn't go quite all the way. He hesitates, and finally he looks back at me. I can't read his expression well, but it isn't angry, at least. You going to be okay? It sounds, to my mind, like goodbye. I nod and say nothing. Because nothing I can say will help. Paranoia bursts out of its shell and starts to wind tendrils around me. What if he doesn't keep his word? What if he gossips, goes online and talks about this? What if he posts who we are? In a way, I realize, I've made the decision without making any decision. I've closed off options with this conversation. Mel knows where we are. Now Sam Cade knows everything, too. Friend or not, ally or not, I can't trust him. Can't trust anyone. I never could. I've been fooling myself for months now, but the dream is over. It might set my kids back, but I need to protect their bodies first, their minds second. I watch him walk away into the dark, and then I take out my cell and text Absalom. Last message for a while, I send. Leaving soon. Have to burn idents and phones. We'll need new packet on the fly. Can use standby docs for now. It only takes a few seconds to get a reply. I wonder when Absalom sleeps, if he ever does. New idents, same price in Bitcoin. Might take a while. You know the drill. He never asks what's happened to make us run. I'm not sure he even actually cares. I go inside and check the kids. They're fine, living in their own separate worlds. I wish for that peace, that luxury. The savage black joy in Mel's stare has ripped all that away, and now that Sam's gone, I feel naked to the world in a way I never have before. I get another beer and sit at the computer. I follow the steps that Absalom has drilled into me to set the Bitcoin payment. It occurs to me that I'm going to have to burn this computer, too. It has too much info buried in it, and I'll need to take it with me, fry the hard drive, smash it to bits, and sink it in a river. Start over with a new machine from the backup drive. Fresh start, I tell myself, and I try to believe that it isn't just another retreat, another layer of self that I'm stripping away. I'm almost sanded to the bone by now. I start making a mental list of the things to destroy, the things to pack, the things to leave behind. But before I can get very far, I hear a hard, firm volley of knocks on the front door. It's so loud and forceful that it chucks me out of my chair, and I retrieve my handgun before I go to check the security camera feed and see who's outside. It's the police. Officer Graham, tall and broad and as sharply creased as ever. I don't like it, but I put the gun back in the safe, lock it, and open the door. He's been a casual visitor, has eaten at my dining table, but now he doesn't even smile.
Ma'am? He says, I need you to come with me, please.
A number of things flash through my mind as I stare at him. First, he must have been surveilling me to know I'd arrived back home. Either that, or Sam has called him, which is equally possible. Second, this late hour is designed to startle me and keep me off my game. Tactics. I know the game as well as he does. I'm almost certain of that. I wait a few seconds without replying, without moving. I fight the irresistible tide of memory and fear and finally say, It's very late. You're welcome to come inside if you have questions to ask me, but I'm not leaving my kids on their own. No way in hell.
I'll get a colleague to stay with them, he says, but you need to come with me to the station, Miss Proctor.
I stare him down. Gina Royal, the poor, stupid weakling, would have fluttered and complained and still gone along passively. She'd been nothing but passive. Unfortunately for Officer Graham, I'm not Gina Royal. Warrant, I say in a flat, business-like tone. Got one? It takes him back a step. His eyes study me harder, reevaluating his approach of shock and awe. I see him consider and reject a few before he says, in a far friendlier tone,
Gwen, this will sure go a whole lot easier if you just come voluntarily. There's no need to put yourself through the mess that happens if we end up getting a warrant, and what happens to your kids if this all gets ramped up and you end up with a criminal record. You think you keep them?
I don't blink, but it's a good line of attack, cunning. You need a warrant to compel me to come to the station with you. Until you do, I don't have to answer any questions, and I choose not to. That's my right. Good night, Officer Graham. I start to close the door. My pulse jumps and my muscles tense as his palm hits the wood and holds it open. If he puts his weight into it, he can push me off balance and step inside. I've already considered options. The gun safe is useless now. Even the fingerprint lock takes too long. He'll be on me before I can clear it. My best move is to fall back to the kitchen, where I have a small .32 concealed at the back of the junk drawer, not to mention a bristling block full of knives. This calculation is involuntary, drilled in by years of paranoia. I don't honestly expect him to turn violent. I just know how to react if he does. Officer Graham stands there, holding the door ajar, looking slightly apologetic.
Ma'am, we've received a tip from someone in the neighborhood that you were seen in a boat out on the water the night that woman's body was put in the lake. As it happens, the description fits the same boat your daughter described. Either you come with me now, or the detectives will be here in half an hour, and they're not taking no for an answer. If it takes a warrant to compel your cooperation, they'll bring one. It'd just be so much easier for you, and show better good faith, if you'd come with me right now.
So what I'm hearing is you've got nothing but an anonymous tip, I say, even while my brain is howling, Sam could have done this to you. But it's more chillingly probable that Mel's behind it somehow. Good luck with that warrant. My record's clean. I'm a law-abiding woman with two kids, and I'm not going anywhere with you. He gives up then and lets me shut the door. I do it quietly, though I want to slam it. My hands are shaking a little as I affix all the locks and bolts back and reactivate the alarm. I turn to see Connor and Lanny standing in the hall, staring at me. Lanny has moved in front of her brother. In her hand is a kitchen knife. It strikes me in that moment how my paranoias touched both of them, especially my daughter, who's so obviously ready to kill to protect her brother, even when there's no immediate threat. I'm so glad she didn't get her hands on a gun. Officer Graham's right. I need to take her to the range and teach her properly, because I know my child, and soon all my orders not to touch the guns won't be enough. She takes her cues from me, though she doesn't want me to know it. As I look at her standing there, holding the knife, pale and afraid, and yet fearless, I love her with an intensity that hurts me. I also fear what I've made her into. It's okay, I say, very gently, though of course it isn't true. Lanny, please put the knife away. Guess it's not a great idea to murder-stab cops, she says. But, Mom, if they come back with some official paperwork, I'll go quietly, I tell her, and you will take care of Connor. Connor, you'll do whatever Lanny says, all right? I'm the man of the house, you know, he grumbles, and it chills me because I hear an echo of his father in it. But unlike his father, it isn't aggressive. It's just a complaint. Lanny rolls her eyes as she slots the knife back in the block, but she doesn't say anything. Instead, she gently shoves Connor in the direction of his room. He plants his feet and doesn't go. He's too busy looking at me, that knot of concern in between his brows, his eyes fierce with worry. Mom, he says, we should get out of here. Now, just leave. What? Lanny blurts it out before she can stop herself, and I can see that the idea hasn't been far from her mind either. She's been dreading the news, and expecting it. I've kept my kids balancing on that knife edge for too long. No, no, we're not. Are we leaving? Do we have to? Tonight? I can see the unmistakable plea in her. She's only just found friends, something she lost in Wichita in an unimaginable whirlwind of horror. She's found, however briefly, a little happiness. But she isn't begging. She's just hoping. I don't need to answer because she does it for herself. She looks down and says, Yeah, yeah, of course we are. We have to, right? If the cops dig deep, they're going to find out. If they take fingerprints, yes. They'll find out who we are. I'm delaying to give us some time. I take a deep breath, so deep it hurts. Go get what you need. One suitcase, okay? You'll look guilty if we run away now, she tells me. And of course, she's right. But I can't stop this train. It's well beyond any control I can exert. If we stay, I risk the storm descending from both sides. Running may make me look guilty, but at least I can get them away from this, get my kids safe, and come back to clear myself. Connor's off like a shot. Lanny looks at me with a mournful silence, then follows. I say, I'm so sorry, to her back.
She says nothing at all.
7. It's damn late, but I call Javier and ask him to bring the van as quick as he can. I tell him the jeep's ready for pickup, and I'll pay him extra for the trouble. He doesn't ask questions, but promises to be with us in half an hour. It's cutting things close. I go to my room, unhook my laptop, and stow it in my go bag for dismemberment and disposal later. It isn't lost on me that in this I have some common ground with my ex-husband.
It's different this time, isn't it? Mel's haunting voice whispers to me as I stuff extras into the bag, things I want to keep. You're not just running from stalkers, or even from me. You're running from the police now. How far do you think you'll get once they're really hunting for you, once everyone is hunting for you? I pause in the act of grabbing the photo album I never leave behind. There are no pictures of Mel in it, just me and the kids and friends. Mel might as well have never existed, except that he's right. Mind Mel, anyway. If I run and they decide I'm worth chasing, it becomes a whole different paradigm. I doubt Absalom will help me evade the law. He'd be the first one to rat me out. There's a knock at the door. I shove the photo album in, zip the bag, and leave it on the bed. Everything else I own is cheaply acquired, easily replaced, and disposable. When I answer the door, Javier is standing there. Thanks, I tell him. I'll get your keys. He interrupts me to say regretfully,
Yeah, about that. We never got around to talking about it. But just so you know, I'm a reserve deputy.
Heard on the radio that they were looking to question you right about the time you called about the van. You're not going anywhere, Gwen. I had to make the call. Standing right behind him is Detective Prester. He's wearing a dark suit today and a blue tie so ineptly knotted, I wonder if he just made a square knot and called it good. He seems tired and pissed off, and in his hand is a crisp, triple-folded piece of paper with an official seal showing on the front. He says,
I'm disappointed, Miss Proctor. I thought we had some kind of civil conversation between us, but you were about to go and run away on me, and I have to tell you, that doesn't look good. Not at all.
I feel the trap closing over me. It's not a bear trap, but silk strands weaving together into an unbreakable net. I can scream, I can rage, but I can no longer run from this, whatever this is. I give Javier a smile I don't feel and say, It's all right. He doesn't smile back. He's studying me with wary intensity. They are all, I think, well aware that I hold a concealed carry permit. They know I'm dangerous. I wonder if they have snipers out in the darkness. I think about my kids, and I hold up my hands. I'm not armed. Please, check me. Prester does the honors, quick, impersonal sweeps of hands over me, and I flash back to the first time this happened to Gina Royal, bent across the burning hood of the family minivan. Poor, stupid Gina, who'd thought that invasive. She hadn't a clue.
Clean, Prester says. All right. Let's make this nice and easy, shall we?
I'll come quietly if you let me talk to my kids first.
All right. Javier, you go in with her.
Javier nods and reaches down to take a black case from his pocket and slot it onto his belt. A gold-washed deputy's star gleams there. He's officially on duty now. I go inside and find Lanny and Connor sitting tensely, staring at the door. Relief melts over them. But then I see the change as Javier comes in, too, and takes up a guard stance at the door.
Mom?
Lanny's voice breaks a little.
Is everything okay?
I sink down on the sofa and put my arms around them both, holding them close. I kiss them before I say, as gently as I can, I have to go with Detective Prester for now. Everything's okay. Javier is going to stay here with you until I get back. I look up at him, and he nods and looks away. Lanny's not crying, but Connor is, very quietly. He wipes his eyes with both hands, and I can tell he's angry with himself. Neither of them says a word.
I love you both so much, I say,
and then I get up.
Please look out for each other until I'm back.
If you're back, Lanny says. It's almost a whisper. I pretend I didn't hear because if I look at her now, I'll break, and they'll have to drag me away from them. I managed to walk on my own out of the house, down the steps, and I joined Prester at the car. When I look back, I see Javier stepping inside and locking up the house.
"They'll be okay,"
Prester tells me. He ushers me into the back and ducks in after me. It's like sharing a cab, I think, except the doors don't open from the inside. At least the ride's free. Graham gets in the front seat and drives. Prester doesn't say anything, and I don't get any kind of vibe from him. It's like sitting next to a piece of sun-warmed granite that smells faintly of dry cleaning fluid and old spice. I don't know what I smell like to him. Fear, probably. The sweaty aroma of a guilty woman. I know how cops think, and they wouldn't have come to get me if I wasn't a, as they like to term it, person of interest. Which is a suspect that they haven't quite collected enough evidence on to charge. I worry about Lanny, with so much responsibility landing on her at just the wrong time in her life. Then I realize I'm thinking like I'm actually guilty, which I'm not. Not of the murder at the lake. Not of anything except marrying the wrong man and failing to notice he was the devil wearing human skin. I take in a slow breath, let it out, and say, "Whatever you think I did, you're wrong."
"I never said you did anything," Prester says. "To borrow a colorful phrase from the English, you're helping us with our inquiries."
He's nearly as bad at British accents as he is at ties. "I'm a suspect, or you wouldn't have a warrant," I tell him flatly. For answer, Prester unfolds the paper. It's good official stock with the logo of the city on the top and the word warrant printed on it in bold letters. But where the particulars should be, it's just nonsense words graphic designers use to fill space. Lorem ipsum. I've used the same text so often I can't help but let out a soft laugh.
"Ain't no way we could get a warrant with the information we have right now, Miss Proctor. I'll tell you that for free."
Nice prop. Does it work often?
"All the damn time. Fools around here take one look at it and think it's in official state Latin or some such nonsense."
This time I laugh, because I can imagine a drunk, angry guy trying to parse out the words, official state Latin. "So what's really so urgent that you have to come get me in the middle of the night?" Prester's near imaginary smile vanishes, and he looks unreadable.
"Your name. You've been living a whole pack of lies, and let me tell you, it doesn't exactly sit well with me. We got an anonymous call about your real name today and heard you might be planning to beat it out of town, so I had to move fast."
I go a little cold, but I'm not really surprised. It was a logical play for my ex-husband to make my life harder and more miserable. Any little spiteful thing to hurt. It also locked me here in Norton and prevented me from starting the cycle again. Instead of answering, I turn my head.
"You know how strange all this looks," Prester says. "Don't you?"
I don't answer. There's really nothing I can say to make any of it better. I just wait as the cruiser bumps onto the main road leading to Norton, and we speed toward town. I don't flinch when Prester spreads out the photos in front of me. Why would I? I've been faced with Melvin Royal's gruesome work 100 times now. I'm fully acclimated to the horror. There are only two that still wake a flutter in my chest. The photo of the woman hanging limp from a wire noose in my old garage, naked and yet stripped even further by the removal of pieces of her skin. The one taken underwater of Mel's garden of women, floating eerily in the dark, with their legs chained tight to weights, some hardly more than skeletons. He'd made a science of body disposal, of exactly how much weight to use, calculated it, using trial and error with dead animals, until he was sure how much to add to keep the bodies down. That all came out at court. Mel is worse than a monster. He's a smart monster. I know it doesn't help me that my expression stays calm as I look at all this horror, and my body doesn't flinch. But I know, too, that faking it will be transparent. I look across the array of photos to meet Prester's gaze. "If you're looking to shock me, you'll have to do better than this. Try to imagine how many times I've had to look at these before." He doesn't answer. Instead, he slides one more photo onto the pile. It was, I realize, taken on the docks of Stillhouse Lake, probably the one not far from my front door. I can see the worn wingtip shoes that Prester's wearing right now peeking in the edge of the shot, and regulation polished black ones that must belong to a uniformed officer, maybe Officer Graham. I am noting the shoes to avoid studying what's in the center of the picture. The young woman is barely recognizable once I'm forced to focus on her. She is an anatomy lesson of pink muscle and dull yellow ligaments, with the occasional flash of white bone. Sunken, clouded eyes, and a weedy fall of wet, dark hair that half hides part of her skinned face. Her lips are intact, which makes the whole obscenity worse. I don't want to think why her lips are still full and perfect.
"She was weighted down some," Prester says. "Rope got cut by the motor, though, and the gut of bacteria brought her back up. You know, it wouldn't have taken much to keep her on the bottom since her skin's gone. Lots of places for gases to escape. I suppose you'd know all about that, though. Wasn't that how your husband did it?"
Mel's victims had never floated. He'd have collected another dozen for his silent, drifting garden if the event hadn't happened. That was one thing Mel wasn't guilty of, being bad at what he chose to do. I say only, Melvin Royal liked to do this kind of thing to women, if that's what you mean.
"And he disposed of his girls in the water, didn't he?"
I nod. Now that I've fixed my gaze on the dead girl, I can't look away. It hurts, like staring into the sun. I know the after image will stay burned on my brain for the rest of my life. I swallow, and my throat clicks. I cough, and suddenly the urge to vomit comes hard. I hold it back, somehow, though sweat breaks out against my suddenly cold skin. Prester notices. He has a bottle of water and pushes it across to me. I uncap and gulp, grateful for the cool, glassy weight that gathers in my stomach. I drain half the bottle before I recap it and set it aside. It's a gambit, of course, for my DNA. I don't care. If he chooses to wait for it, he could request confirmation from the Kansas PD. I'm documented, printed, photographed, and filed, and though the old Gina Royal is dead to me, we still share the same blood and bone and body.
"You see my problem," he tells me in that warm, slow voice. It drones deep, and I think of old-time hanging judges, hoods, ropes, nooses.
I think of the girl swaying from the end of a wire.
"You were involved in a case like this back in Kansas. Got tried for being an accomplice. It might be hard to see it as some kind of coincidence happening again so close to you, is my point."
I never knew about what Mel did. Never. Until the day of the accident.
"Funny that your neighbor said different."
That puts my back up, despite my efforts to stay calm. "Mrs. Milson? She was a vicious gossip, and she saw that as her chance to be some reality show star. She perjured herself to get on the news. My lawyer destroyed her testimony on the stand. Everyone knows she was lying, and I had nothing to do with it. I was acquitted."
Prester doesn't blink. His expression doesn't shift.
"Acquitted or not, doesn't look so good for you. Same kind of crime, same signature. So let's go through this step by step."
He puts another picture down, covering the first one. In a way, it's almost as upsetting as the first, because I see a fresh-faced young brunette woman with a saucy grin, sitting with her head bent to touch against another woman's. The other woman is the same age, blonde, with a sweetly wistful look. Friends, I think. They're not similar enough to be related.
"This is how she used to look, this girl, Rayne Harrington, we found floating around in our lake. Pretty girl, well-liked around here, 19 years old. Wanted to be a veterinarian."
He adds another photo of her cradling an injured, bandaged dog. It's blatant manipulation, sentimentality, but I still feel it move through me like a subtle earthquake. I shift my gaze.
"Nice, lovely girl without an enemy in the goddamn world. Don't you look away!"
That last comes as a bellow, shockingly loud, and if he expects me to flinch, he will be damn disappointed. If I don't do it at the range, at the kick of the gun in my hand, I fucking well won't show him any weakness here. Good tactic, though. The police back in Kansas could have learned something from Detective Prester. He switched so effortlessly, so quickly, that I've no doubt he'd trained somewhere tough. From his accent, maybe Baltimore. He's broken real criminals. His problem now is that I'm not one of those. I stare steadily at the photos and my heart aches for her, this poor girl. Not because I've done anything to her, but because I'm human.
You took most of her skin off while she was still alive, the detective says softly, almost like one of the many voices I hear in my head, like Mel's voice, for instance. She couldn't even scream because her vocal cords were cut. That's a hell of a thing. Best we can figure, she was tied down at every possible joint, and her head clamped with some kind of leather band. You started at her feet and worked your way up. We can see the exact point where she died from the process, you know. Living tissue has a reaction. Dead tissue doesn't. I say nothing. I do not move. I try not to imagine it, her terror, her agony, the utter pointless horror of what happened to her.
You do it for your husband? For Mel? He make you do it for him?
I guess you think that makes some kind of sick sense, I tell him, and I keep my voice just the same pitch, the same volume. Maybe Detective Prester has voices in his head, too. I hope so. My ex-husband is a monster. Why wouldn't I be, too? What kind of normal woman would marry a man like that, much less stay with him? He stares through me when I look up. I feel the burn, but I don't move from the gaze. Let him look. Let him see. When I married Melvin Royal, I did it because he asked. I wasn't especially pretty. I didn't think I was especially smart. I'd been taught my whole value to the world was making some man a happy little wife and bearing his children. I was perfect for him. An innocent, sheltered virgin who'd been sold the fantasy of a knight in shining armor coming to love and protect me forever. Prester says nothing. He taps a pen against his notepad, watching me. The thing is, yes, I was a fool. I chose to be his perfect stay-at-home wife and mother. Mel made a good living, and I gave him two wonderful kids, and we had a happy home. It was normal. I know you can't believe that. Hell, I can't believe that I did. But I went through all those years of Christmases and birthdays, PTA meetings and dance recitals, drama club and soccer, and nobody suspected a thing. That's his gift, Detective. He's really so very good at playing human that even I couldn't see the difference. Prester lifts his eyebrows.
And here I thought you'd give me the battered woman defense. Isn't that the go-to explanation?
Maybe. I tell him. And maybe most of those women are victims. But Mel wasn't. I flash to that one moment in the bedroom when his hands tightened that padded cord around my throat, when I saw the cold alligator menace behind his eyes, and I'd known instinctively that he wasn't right. Mel is a monster. But that doesn't mean he couldn't be damn good at being everything else, too. How do you think that feels? Knowing you slept with that. Knowing you left your kids with it. Silence. Prester doesn't break it this time. When I looked into that wrecked garage and saw the truth, something changed. I could see. I could understand. Looking back on it, I saw the hints, the little things that didn't fit and didn't make sense. But I know there was no way I could see them at the time, coming from where I was, what I believed. I take another swallow of the water, and the plastic cracks like a pistol shot. After my acquittal, I reinvented myself. I protected my children. You think I'd ever want to do anything for Melvin Royal again? I hate him. I despise him. If he ever shows up in the flesh, I'll put an entire fucking clip of bullets in his head until there's nothing left to recognize. I mean every word of that.
and I know the detective has an instinct for the truth. He doesn't like that, but fuck what he likes. I'm fighting for my life, for the fragile safety I've managed to pull together. Prester says nothing. He just studies me.
You have no evidence, I tell him finally.
Not because I'm some Hannibal Lecter level of clever, but because I didn't do anything to that poor girl. I've never seen her before. I'm sorry for what happened to her, and no, I can't explain why it happened where I live. I wish to God I could. I mean, Mel has followers who worship every word he says, but even then, I don't know how he convinces someone to do that for him. He's not Rasputin. He's not even Manson. I don't know what makes a person that sick. Do you?
Nature, he says flatly. Nurture, brain injuries. Shit, the worst of them got no excuses at all.
He said them, not you. I wonder if he recognizes that.
Why don't you tell me what made Melvin like that, since you've had such a close-up view?
I have no idea, I say, and I mean it. His parents were lovely people. I didn't see them often, and they were always so fragile. Looking back on it now, I think they were afraid of him. I never realized that before they died.
Then what makes you rip up young girls like this?
I let out a sigh. Detective, I married a monster, and I wasn't clever enough to recognize it in time. That's all I did wrong. I didn't do this. We go around and around for about 4 hours. I don't ask for a lawyer, though I think about it. The quality of help I'd get in Norton isn't what I'd call promising. No, I'm better off sticking with the truth. For all his skill, Detective Prester can't convince me of a lie. He might have managed it in the cold, impressionable Gina Royal days, but this isn't my first go-round, and he knows that. He has nothing. He's got an anonymous call implicating me, and that could be from a troll who's discovered my identity, or another person my ex has paid off to stir the pot. Still, his instincts are right. It's no accident, this poor woman being slaughtered in such a familiar way and dumped in the lake just beyond my home. Someone's sending a message. It has to be Mel. In a strange, uneasy turn, I actually hope it is, because at least I know Mel. I know where he is. But he has help, I think. Help willing to do exactly what Mel asks. And I won't lie. That frightens me deeply. I don't want to find Lanny dead next, or Connor slaughtered in his bed. I don't want to die at the end of a wire noose, burning in unspeakable agony from being flayed alive. It's the wee hours when Prester sends me home. Norton is a ghost town, not a single other vehicle on the empty streets, and the deep night gets darker and darker as the squad car turns for the lake. It's Officer Lancel Graham driving me, I suppose because that means he can head straight home afterward. He doesn't talk to me. I don't try to start a conversation. I lean my head against the cool glass and wish I could sleep. I won't sleep tonight, or probably tomorrow, either. The photos of that murdered young woman will flare into horrific color against my eyelids, and I won't be able to blink them away. Mel isn't haunted by his victims. He always slept soundly and woke rested. I'm the one who has nightmares.
We're here, says Graham, and I realize that the sedan has stopped, that somehow I closed my eyes and drifted off, after all, into an uneasy doze.
I thank him as he comes around and opens the door. He even offers me a hand out, which I take for politeness, and then I am unsettled when he doesn't let go immediately. I can see him. No. Feel him watching me.
I believe you, he says, which surprises me. Prester's on a bad trail, Miss Proctor. I know you have nothing to do with this. Sorry, I realize it's tearing up your life.
I wonder how much Prester has said, and if the news about my other name, about Gina Royal, has started to leak already. I don't think so. Graham doesn't have the look of someone who knows about my ex-husband. He just seems sorry and a little concerned. I thank him again, more warmly, and he lets me go.
Javier steps out onto the porch as I approach, and he's juggling his car keys in his hand, impatient to be gone, I think.
The kids, I begin.
They're fine, he says, cutting me off. Asleep, or at least pretending to be. He gives me a sharp, merciless look.
He kept you a long time.
It's not me, Javier. I swear that. He murmurs something that's